every election that we have is like the most important election that's ever happened and ever will happen. And so the idea of not talking to some of those voters that you're trying to mobilize or persuade is scary. Like, what if you lose by just a few votes, and because you took 20% of your total audience and said, okay, we're not going to talk to these people just so we have a control group, what if that ends up making the difference between winning and losing?
Welcome to Crosstabs, the podcast that tries to explain how polls are designed and conducted, who they include, who they leave out, what they say, and what they don't say, so you can better navigate yet another most important election year in history. I'm your host, Farah Bostic, founder of The Difference Engine, a research-backed strategy studio helping leaders make big decisions. Each episode, we take a look at the art and science of polling. No takes, no spin, no predictions. This time, we have help from Amelia Showalter, the co-founder and CEO of Pantheon Analytics, a boutique data firm working in politics and nonprofits. Her background is in politics and data science. As you'll hear, she was director of digital analytics for the Obama campaign in 2012. She spoke with me about how campaigns use data experiments to develop messaging strategies for fundraising, volunteering, and get out the vote efforts. We also talk about redistricting and vote by mail, two areas in which she has a lot of deep expertise. Let's dig in.
So I started in 2008 working on sort of micro-targeting and other types of data modeling, media modeling. But then my big break, big leagues in the political world, was working on the 2012 Obama campaign, where I was the director of digital analytics. And ever since then, I did some freelancing for a while, and then started this small company that does, we're sort of a jack of all trades kind of data firm. We do a lot of different types of bespoke projects where, you know, sometimes it's infrastructure, sometimes it's voter file analysis, sometimes it's modeling. Like, we try to sort of keep things interesting for ourselves by working on a lot of different things.
Yeah. When we spoke before, you talked about that kind of approach of like, there's lots of things we can do with data. And so rather than having like, here's the one thing we do, or there's lots of ways you can help campaigns be smart.
One of my personal inspirations for putting together a company like this was just before working on the Obama campaign in 2012, I had had a stint working on a redistricting project. Which, you know, redistricting is fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of data involved, census data and mapping and, you know, creating projections for what you think the different maps are going to look like. But of course, that's something that only comes around every 10 years, asterisk, because sometimes redistricting goes on for a while because of court decisions or gerrymandering or whatever. But in general, it's a once every 10 years kind of project, and no one would build a business around something that happens only once every 10 years. But, you know, when I looked at that and how interesting that experience was, I thought, okay, if you cobble together projects like that and then different other types of sort of random one-off projects, you can put together a company without just having to do the same kind of polling or modeling or things like that that other data firms were doing. So that's why we kind of specialize in the offbeat project.
As a New Yorker now, I think I can say that after 20 some years of living here, it feels like it's been ongoing.
New York in particular, your redistricting may never stop.
We got new maps yesterday, I'm told. So it's all very exciting. Now I live out in the New York First Congressional District, which has been non-competitive for a very long time, which is weird when you actually start to look at like voter registration by census tract, which I nerded out one day and did because I had access to entry. And I was just like looking through all of that going, why isn't it more competitive? Like, the registration data suggests it should be way more competitive than it is, but the turnout doesn't work out that way. Anyway, so now they've apparently redistricted, my husband tells me, which means we should brace ourselves for a lot more phone calls, texts, and advertising.
Oh, I was going to say, you're going to get so many ads, so many pieces of mail, text messages. Get ready.
People are going to finally tromp down our gravel driveway to find us, whereas before they didn't bother.
Yeah, you'll get canvassers.
It'll be amazing. So one of the things that I want to get into is, I think, like, people really fixate on polls and the day-to-day polling data and that kind of horse race coverage of things. But what I want to talk about, and maybe this actually kind of goes back to some of what you did for the Obama campaign as director of analytics, is like, analytics is a whole different beast. It's not really about the day-to-day polling. So maybe you could just sort of talk broadly about how campaigns use data in that kind of analytics function.
So just minor correction, I was the director of digital analytics, which is actually is a good intro to how campaigns use analytics, which is to say we used analytics in so many different functions that not only was there a digital analytics team within the digital department, which was my team, but there was a whole analytics department, like an entirely separate department that was doing analytics for so many other parts of what was happening in the campaign. So the analytics department was building those models and testing things out and keeping track of, you know, all of the different contacts and innovating the way that the campaign reached out to people and monitored where we were. The digital analytics side was also really interesting. You know, what we did primarily was fundraising. You know, digital fundraising was so huge, still is so huge. You know, the campaign raised over $1 billion. And I think more than half of what we raised as a campaign, we raised online. And so a lot of what we were doing on our side in the analytics world was optimizing that fundraising through A/B testing and some amount of targeting. You know, I mean, we would at least know who was an active donor, who was a recent donor, you know, I mean, who was inactive, and maybe we shouldn't bother them quite as much unless we know we have a really good email, things like that. But, you know, a lot of it really was just testing out what worked, randomizing groups of email addresses and, you know, sending different subject lines, different drafts, different formatting. You know, should we put a little call out box in the corner? You know, should we include their supporter record? You know, how much they had donated so far? Should we not include that? You know, just testing out just lots of things to see what actually got more people to give to the campaign.
So what's interesting about that, I think, is there's a kind of evolution of how campaigns have gathered that kind of data and then also how they run these experiments. Because I'm old enough to remember and enough of a news junkie to remember that this was something that sort of historically, in more of a direct marketing sense, the Republican Party was really strong at. Karl Rove was like famous for this as like his big innovation was essentially A/B testing direct mail to see what turned people out, what got donations, what got people to sign up somewhere for, you know, volunteering, that kind of thing. But then, you know, we have the kind of move into online fundraising, which is often also attributed to Howard Dean, but moving into the internet phase of it, there's a lot more theoretical flexibility about what you can try. And so maybe talk about how you leverage technology to try a lot of different kinds of experiments and test out different approaches.
I think in particular on a presidential campaign where you have just an enormous number of email addresses or, you know, numbers you can send text messages to, the sample size actually is one of the biggest advantages there. You can test out so many things and have enough sample size to actually have some confidence in your results. You know, if you have a small sample size, then if you tested out a bunch of different subject lines at once, you know, maybe you'd only get one donation to this subject line and two donations to that subject line and one donation for another one. And that just like, it wouldn't be enough to really like mean very much. But when you have an email list with, you know, 3 million people on it, you can randomize off a few little subsections and test out a lot of different things and actually get pretty good numbers back quickly. You know, within an hour, we could see like, oh, okay, so this email draft and this subject line is doing the best. So that's what we're going to send out to the full list and know that we're sending out a really good email. So just the sample size made it really possible to test things out, see what worked, but also just the pace was, you know, it's like you start sending a few emails a day. And every time you do that, you can test something out. You can learn a lot. You know, we tested out, should we include ugly yellow highlighting on particular parts of the email? Should we mention things that were relevant in the news? Should we take a more positive tone? Should we take a more negative tone, meaning like, oh no, what if we don't raise as much money as the Romney campaign? You know, like we could just sort of test out all of those things. We just had a lot of opportunities for testing.
That's amazing.
Whereas like in the direct mail, you know, you can still do that. And the campaign still did testing over in the direct mail team, but you have to wait longer for that to come back. You're not getting the results back almost instantaneously like you do with digital.
So that is also an interesting component. So I come out of the marketing universe where there has been much made about the ability to do A/B testing of headlines or different banner ads, with the idea being that we're getting this rapid feedback, so therefore we can make in-flight changes to the campaign. Except that most marketing departments at major brands are not really set up to do that because of like approvals processes for I think this depends on what kind of agency you work with or that sort of thing. But typically, you're not starting out with like a very long list of potential headlines. You've narrowed it down to like four or five that the client has approved. So you only have so many tests you can run. And the other problem, of course, is you're not on the receiving end of the data. So like, you can kind of count what you can count, but you have no idea whether it's moving the needle on sales or subscriptions or any of those kinds of things.
Right, right.
Talk a bit about the experiment design side of it. How do you decide how many messages to test, which kinds of messages to test, who comes up with the messages to test?
On a presidential campaign, it is a big group effort. So within our team, way back on the 2012 campaign, there was our digital analytics team, but there was a whole email team that was full of email writers that would write all the different drafts. We would collaborate on how much of our list do we want to burn just doing these tests so that we still have a bunch of a list left over. Now, of course, when I work with clients that have smaller email lists, you know, it just can't be that extensive because, again, you wouldn't have the sample size to do it. And so usually what we'll do is we'll figure out, all right, if we siphon up 20-30% of the list to do this testing, and we can divide that into two or three sections, how many people are in each of those sections? What is sort of a reasonable expectation for how many clicks we would get, opens we would get, ideally donations we would get if it's a fundraising email, or, you know, maybe it's a petition signature email, you know, how many signatures we would get. And you can just run a rough power calculation. It's a pretty simple statistical calculation to see what's the minimum detectable effect here. Like, how different would these versions of the email have to perform for us to see something kind of useful in there? And so it's a lot more limited when you have a smaller list.
Yeah. And that is, I think, the interesting benefit there of having a list of the size that a campaign like the Obama campaign had.
Yeah.
Are what sort of this size or scale of a campaign that you have to reach before you can really start to see the benefits of these kinds of approaches? Like, I'm thinking about, you know, probably the people running for my town council are not have enough names on their list to run these kinds of tests, right?
Probably not. No. I mean, if you have a small list, but it's extraordinarily responsive, then you can get away with, you know, still having a small sample size. But if you have lots of people clicking on your email or making a donation every time, then actually you can still run tests with a small list. But in general, when we're talking about online fundraising, we're talking about like 1 out of 1,000, 1 out of 10,000,
right?
You know, like people on your list that are going to make a donation in any kind of short time frame. So, you know, in general, we're talking about lists that are in the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, where you can still do, you know, pretty good A/B testing.
This is, I think, a part of campaigns that are maybe not totally visible to voters, right?
So, yeah, they don't know that they're getting a test. Although I suppose if they've sort of accidentally signed up for a list with multiple email addresses, then they might see like, huh, I got like two different subject lines. Strange. But it was kind of funny. You know, we were doing all this testing and ProPublica, who I love, a good news organization, actually did a little bit of analytics for work for them after the campaign. But the funny thing there is that during the 2012 campaign, they had their readers send in all these different emails that they were getting from the Obama campaign, and then also include their, you know, demographics. Because ProPublica was trying to decipher the supposed, you know, demographic targeting that we were doing. You know, sending this subject line to young white women and this subject line to older Southerners or whatever it was. And they just found some noise, basically. And I had to tell them after the campaign, like, oh, that was all random. Like, that was just completely randomized. And, you know, like, so maybe you think you're getting targeted by something, but actually there's a pretty good chance that it's just random.
This, I love this story because I find that journalists are particularly interested in the idea of micro-targeting. And you know, the same is true for in the marketing universe, right? Like, how much is Facebook engaged in micro-targeting? How much are brands using Facebook's advertising platforms to micro-target people? And there are definitely marketers and content creators and whatever who are using those tools in all kinds of, if not ethically questionable, then just sort of like effectively questionable kind of ways. But the reality of most major brands is they're trying to go for reach, right? Like they're not really trying to have these little thin sliced marketing segments. For one thing, it's a whole lot of effort and expense to create assets for each of those little groups. And it's also a real pain to get that information in the first place to like be able to do it with them. And in your case, that would be a whole lot of effort. When just doing, with a list the size that you were working with, when just doing these randomized split tests is more efficient than trying to like do something else.
Right. Well, and also, I mean, how are we supposed to, even if we could segment out everyone, which you can, I mean, we have voter files, whether we're talking about, you know, messaging supporters who are on the on an email list, or if you're talking about messaging voters who are on the voter file, there's a lot of information we know about everybody. So theoretically, we could segment everybody out. But then how are you supposed to know exactly what they want to hear? You can do focus groups or you can do some polls. And so maybe you can find some sort of general ideas of what issues matter to people. But like, yeah, when you have to put together a whole message, how do you know you're going to get it right? We had a sort of a particular thing that really proved this to me, that it's like we're kind of bad at guessing exactly what people want to hear, which was that when I was on the 2012 campaign, we had a little betting pool in the office for a while where, you know, all these different subject lines and email drafts, you know, which a lot of them were very different. On any given day, we were sending out an email, maybe one of the options focused on the deadline and the other option was really talking about how much our opponent would be bad as the president. And, you know, lots of different things. And so for a little while, I had people in the office just, you know, like on my team, on the email team, make a bet about which email draft and subject line they thought would win and which one they thought they would lose when we did these, you know, randomized A-B tests. Because my goal, I mean, I think everyone else's goal was sort of for bragging rights to see like, oh, I'm always good at identifying the winner. My goal was actually just to see if like people could identify losers, because if we could identify losers in advance, then we wouldn't have to burn at some of our list testing them. You know, we could just say like, all right, let's just test fewer things and not send these ones that we all know are going to be losers. But we were really bad at it. Like nobody got it right. We were worse than chance. Nobody in the office was like the person who just knew which one was going to hit and which one was going to fail. And to me, it's like, it's hard to target, or it's hard to know exactly what your audience is going to respond the best to, especially since we're weird people, you know, like we like a bunch of people sitting in a campaign office who think about politics all day long. That's not our audience. Even though we were messaging Obama supporters, they have lots of other things going on, different kinds of messages that might appeal to them versus what appeals to a bunch of weirdos in a political office. And so I don't know. I think that by doing these kinds of tests, you can identify what has broad appeal to a lot of people without having to sort of know in advance, like, ah, this is the message that I think is going to work. Because a lot of times our instincts are wrong.
Right. Well, and I think the other thing there is, in order to have any kind of hypotheses about how do white women under 28 want to be addressed, speaking as a qualitative researcher and a market researcher, like the efforts that would be required to start to figure that out, again, become extremely time consuming and costly. Like you would need to spend, you'd have to pick, I don't know, whatever, 10 major subgroups by demographics and then spend a year studying them just because it takes time to write them all or do focus groups with them all. And having done a little bit of political focus group work, what we typically wind up with is like a group of independent voters, a mix of men and women. They're a mix of ages. Some of them are homeowners. Some of them are not. Some of them have kids. Some of them don't. Like all of those kinds of things that would be obvious potential reasons people would react differently to messages on a demographics basis. They're all mixed together in a room. And it's just kind of like, well, what resonates with independent voters? You know, first of all, I think what a great exercise to place bets on what do you think is going to be a winner and what do you think is going to be a loser. I used to do the same thing in comms testing for brands. And, you know, sometimes people were right. And this was often because they had really deep knowledge of that group of people that was the target audience. And the people who did not have deep knowledge of them were more likely to be wrong. Like, I think that's probably generally true. But even then, I mean, the example that always comes to mind is years and years and years ago, we did some research for a tech company that was doing like edge security software for networks. And we were doing focus groups about this. You can imagine how exciting they were. But the creative was funny. And the client was really skeptical that IT decision makers were going to think that anything related to edge security should or could be funny. And instead, they loved it because it was their kind of humor, right? It was IT guy humor. And so, like, it worked really well, but everyone would have been wrong on the placing of the bet.
Yeah, because it's very hard to project yourself. I mean, especially when you're talking about persuasion or, you know, talking to groups that don't already agree with you.
Right.
Whatever that is, whether that's voters or IT people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard to put yourself in their head. I remember a really interesting study. Say it was from 2015, maybe even earlier. And I wish I could remember the researchers. I think it's some academics that did it. But they basically did some testing of messages on various topics, you know, towards liberals, towards conservatives. They essentially tried out the types of messages that liberals like, or liberals would say, oh, well, if we're trying to convince these conservatives to support gay marriage, I think this was before it was legal nationwide. You know, what do you think would be the most persuasive message? And of course, liberals, the type of messages we think would work is like, oh, we're talking about love and equality and fairness and, you know, human rights and all that. But it turns out, like, if you test that against conservatives, that tests much more poorly than a message that's saying like, well, you know, these gay couples are taxpaying Americans and they're patriotic and they just want to get married and have traditional values. And it's like, those are messages that I, as a liberal, as a, you know, bleeding heart, gay rights loving liberal, probably wouldn't come up with because it's not what's in my head. Right. But like, it turns out that if you're trying to persuade people who aren't like you, you kind of have to use their language. Yes. And, you know, they actually, I think the same paper, they did it in the opposite way too, like trying to get, you know, bleeding heart liberals like me to support military funding. Yeah. And so, you know, the conservative message would be like, well, we need a strong military and we got to beat up everybody in the world or whatever, you know, and it's like, that doesn't work on a bleeding heart liberal like me. But if you, turns out that if you say things like, well, the military is the greatest engine for equality because it gives people, you know, it gives the poor and working class kids a chance to rise up and make the most of themselves, and they go on to be, you know, members of society that are promoting equality. I don't know, like, basically you just like, you talk about equality a lot. Then suddenly we're like, yeah, yay military funding. But, you know, it's like, you wouldn't think of that. Like, if you're sitting in a room, and especially like, let's say you're a conservative, and you're trying to get someone to support you on military funding, you're probably not going to think to talk about equality.
Right.
You know?
Right.
It's the point is that we're all very bad at like projecting ourselves into the other people's shoes.
Right. And yet you are able to run these experiments and get some amount of feedback on what's converting to whatever behavior you're hoping to convert to. And so one of the things when we talked earlier that I was really intrigued about was the idea of, because again, I think coming out of the marketing universe, a lot of those tests just kind of get lost to time, right? Like, we ran the experiment for this campaign. It performed this way or it performed that way. And next campaign, it's all fresh. Like, we don't look back at what we did before to figure out what we can learn for what we're going to do next. But it sounded like one of the kind of disciplines here is tracking what works and trying to divine from that, like, insight into what we should do next. So maybe you can talk a bit about how this builds up kind of a learning cycle for campaigns. And also, like, the challenge of applying it quickly, because campaigns are incredibly long in the US, but still time limited. There is an end date.
Yeah. There are some experiments that can happen within the course of a campaign. So, you know, like a presidential campaign will probably test out different scripts for canvassers when they're going door to door, or phone scripts, text messages, things like that. And, you know, they can start to learn what works, even if they don't know that that is going to get someone to vote for you. At least, you know, you can kind of, you know, ask some questions before the canvas, after the canvas, get a sense of what is moving people towards your side. Or if it's a mobilization script, how many of those folks that you talk to with script A said, yes, okay, now I have a plan to vote. Or you contact them again and say like, all right, just checking in, like, do you know what day the election day is, or whatever it is. There are some ways you can sort of get some metrics within the campaign before election day itself. But it is true. Like a lot of the times when we're running experiments, it's something that we're doing for next time. You know, we're trying to learn something that sort of helps the progressive movement as a whole by learning something now that would be useful in the next election cycle. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. Sometimes it's really hard to convince campaigns and organizations to do that, because what you're asking people to do in that case is usually to segment off a control group that you don't talk to, that you don't deliver a treatment to. And, you know, every election that we have is like the most important election that's ever happened and ever will happen. And so the idea of not talking to some of those voters that you're trying to mobilize or persuade is scary. What if you lose by just a few votes, and because you took 20% of your total audience and said, okay, we're not going to talk to these people just so we have a control group. What if that ends up making the difference between winning and losing? And so sometimes it is really hard to convince people to include a control group.
That is a particularly interesting thing. I was thinking about this the other day, looking at, I guess it was the exit polls from New Hampshire for the GOP primary. And a really high percentage of New Hampshire GOP voters said that they had not been contacted by any campaign. It was like in the high 70s, they said that they had not been contacted by any campaign, which I found myself thinking, surely not. First of all, just like not that big of a state. Second, like it is the first primary, so there would be some amount of contest. You would assume that the campaigns would be attempting to contact people. Do you think that that's just like people don't remember being contacted? I think in particular, this was Haley voters who said that no one had contacted them.
I don't know. I mean, that surprises me. I guess I don't know the sort of the ins and outs of who qualifies to vote in the New Hampshire primary. I think it's an open primary. Independent, you can vote. And so, you know, maybe that was just poor targeting from the Haley campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, they really probably should be talking to a lot more people than just, you know, 4 out of 4 Republican primary voters. Although it's good to start with the people who are most likely to turn
right.
out. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think that this particular Republican primary is so weird, is so different that I imagine it doesn't operate sort of the way that a normal primary would.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I also suspect, you know, thinking about metrics we use in testing campaigns, we're not fans of recall anyway as a metric, because people generally have pretty low recall, but recognition is
or inaccurate recall, right? Like if you talk to people who haven't seen the ad, like a good percentage of them will say that they did, right?
Yeah, either positively or negatively, they won't remember having seen an ad, or they will when they hadn't actually been served an ad.
Yeah.
The other part of it is like when we then show, so a technique, for example, in testing recognition is to take like a part of a 30-second TV spot that doesn't have the brand in it. And just show them a few seconds and say, like, do you recognize this ad? And then they'll say yes or no. And if they say yes, then we say, well, what brand do you think this is for? And give them, you know, maybe it's open-ended, maybe we give them some choices. And so that, like, that aided awareness, that is an ad for Tide detergent or whatever, when Tide is not visible in the shot, that's a better measure for us.
Yeah.
So one thing I wonder about is, like, do people just not remember having been contacted, or do they think that contact means something that it doesn't mean? Like, do they mean like a Haley person knocked on my door, I answered the door and I talked to them, or would they count the door knocker that gets left, or the flyer that got sent to them, or those,
or the TV ad that they saw that was on sort of in the background,
right?
Or a pre-roll ad. I mean, that, you know, I think ads online, I mean, a lot of times it's very easy to just feel like, oh, I didn't really see that, you know, like that's just something I wanted to click past to get to my YouTube video.
Exactly. Oh God, yes. The other thing though that I feel like is, look, we're both liberals here, so probably consuming more liberal media than conservative media, but there's definitely a little discourse around like the subject lines and the tone of some of the messages that people get throughout a campaign.
Yeah.
And a lot of, I feel like, maybe justified, maybe not. I don't know. I mean, I know that I start to, as the campaign wears on, start to feel particularly worn down by the "it's getting terrible out there," you know, kind of messages. But maybe you have a point of view about that. Like, if there's a criticism that like these negative feeling or weighty feeling text messages and email subject lines maybe aren't so great for the brand of the campaign.
Well, I mean, it's tough, because if you run any particular test, maybe it usually shows that something that's sort of more clickbait or more dire warnings, all caps, whatever, maybe it does win. That is kind of a bummer because it's like, I don't think email writers is sitting in their campaign office. They don't really like writing that either. But then you kind of got to go with what works. And like, if that's what's working, your campaign has enormous financial need. And, you know, I do think that there is something to the, like, especially for organizations that are ongoing. So if you are a state party or if you are a big advocacy organization that's going to go on for years and years, you know, you don't want to completely burn your list to the ground and just like irritate people. So I think you do have to think about your brand there. And actually, I hope that more organizations try doing some long-term testing where it's like, all right, split your whole audience into two and then like have one half of them receive whatever you were going to do anyway. And then the other half, maybe you do tone down the all caps or maybe you tone down the volume. Right. The only downside with that, you have to wait a long time to see if it pays off, because in the short term, you probably are going to lose money, you right. know, by not having the high volume. You know, on the Obama campaign, we did a test and we called it the more email test. You know, we were already sending quite a few emails. Let's say we were sending 7 emails a week, you know, like on average of one a day at that point in the campaign. Maybe we were sending more than one a day at that point. But we had a track of people that for 3 or 4 weeks, we sent additional emails. Mm-hmm. Like we just sent them one extra email every day beyond what we were doing for everybody else. And we raised more money from them. And like, it didn't really drop off either. It wasn't the case that like we raised more money in the very short term and then we saw it trail off. And, you know, we only had a few months left of the election at that point anyway. So we just started sending more emails to everybody. And, you know, probably it meant literal tens of millions of dollars in additional funding for the campaign.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, I don't blame people if the math says like, hey, we did some testing and the answer is send all caps. It's kind of hard to say no to that.
Well, and I think that this is a pretty fundamental advertising principle of you have both reach and frequency. I think that frequency matters right. quite a bit. It's why Temu bought like 4 spots during the Super Bowl and spent no money on the ad. Like the ad was cheap, the buy was expensive, but now there are multiple headlines about what is Temu and should you let your mom buy things from it? But like that reach and frequency thing is just like a standard age old kind of maxim of advertising. And, you know, I think one of the challenges of any of the kind of public discourse around whether it's polling or message testing or this kind of use of digital analytics is the people who are paying attention are people who pay a lot of attention, right? Like they are junkies for this stuff. They are maybe themselves former campaign workers or worked in the White House. I might be thinking of some specific guys right now. And like the reaction is outsized because they pay closer attention to all the messages they are receiving from the campaigns they care about. Whereas the average person,
right.
the reason that 2 emails a day worked better than 1 email a day was you caught them at a point in time when they opened the email, right? Like
exactly. Yeah. That's sort of my theory of the case is that like you just got to be there when they themselves are ready. I mean, you have some optimization within that moment. And that's why like some subject lines do better than others. But in terms of the frequency, that's just about like being available at the right moment when somebody already kind of has their own intrinsic desire to make a donation or buy a product or cast a vote, you know?
Well, and I think this also then is related in my mind to some of the work that you've done with redistricting, because the thing I think a lot about, again, as a qualitative researcher, is local knowledge and like doing anything that's really regionally specific. By rights, I should be doing a lot more legwork before I ever get into a room with people to start talking to them about their experiences, because I just don't have the context. Like if I've never walked into a Publix grocery store, I don't understand what that shopping experience is like. But in the kind of building of local models for things like redistricting, that local knowledge is something that seems like it would be really important for understanding, you know, the implications of any decision that might get made, any line that gets drawn. And so maybe talk about how those pieces all fit together, how you get there to a place where you understand a place well enough to be able to work on projects like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, redistricting, I mean, that's part of the sort of mandate of redistricting is that you know keep communities of interest together. And so, you know, knowing not just where people are, but where school district boundaries are and where, you know, like, oh, on this side of the river, that community is not going to cross over the river as much or whatever. You know, it's like just sort of knowing those things is sort of part of redistricting. And, you know, a map that people feel is fair is one that keeps communities of interest together as much as possible. Sometimes it's not totally possible. You know, I worked on redistricting in a particular state that had a lot of mountains. And so if you didn't understand that there's like mountains in the middle of some district, you might think, oh, that looks like a good normal district. But, you know, it might mean that there's a group of people that are part of a district where there's literally no road to the other part of this district because there's just a big set of mountains in between.
Right.
And that's not like the greatest thing to do. So, yeah, I mean, redistricting was really interesting. The model that I built for that way back in 2011 after the 2010 census, this was in a particular state where, you know, it was tough. It had been a very tied legislature. And in the past several redistrictings, the legislature had never been able to agree on a map. And so it would always go to the courts or the Secretary of State. And yeah, we were just able to build this model that really sort of let us know, all right, the political implications of this map are going to be X, Y, Z. But also this map keeps communities of interest together. Like this isn't, you know, this isn't gerrymandered. Actually, it didn't even feel like it was like just entirely redrawing a map from scratch. You know, it was sort of building on the previous map. And yeah, that was just, it was very interesting. And that did require a lot of local knowledge, including just even for the political implications. You know, I mean, like my model would include things like, was that incumbent appointed or not appointed? And, you know, if you're just going in, it's like, ah, well, that person's already a representative. So therefore, that's an incumbent. So I should mark them down as a one in the column where I do having the data on incumbency. But, you know, then someone would say, oh, no, that person was just appointed to that. No one's ever actually voted for that person. Right. That person's never been on a ballot before. And so it was really important, you know, when I was working there to talk to people on the ground. Or even the model would divide the state into various regions. And like, how am I supposed to know where is the edge between sort of the city and the suburbs? Where is the edge between sort of this rural area and that rural area? And that, I mean, it's kind of vibes based, but like if you talk to people on the ground, they'd be like, yeah, like these counties are kind of a cluster of counties. Like this is where the sort of dividing line is between what we feel is the city and the suburbs. Having those region variables in my model added a lot to the model. And so, you know, it was really good to get that local knowledge.
It's really just, I used to live in Los Angeles and initially I lived on one side of the hills and then I moved to the other side of the hills. And what was fascinating was living in the San Fernando Valley in Studio City, very close to the hill, that there was a general kind of political attitude about, literally people would say things like, we're sending our tax dollars over the mountain, over the Hollywood Hills into LA. Somehow we're not in LA. And like, and we're not getting them back. Like that feeling about things. Most states have a kind of big urban rural divide. And I remember those conversations about the state college system from where I grew up of like either people in the cities feeling like their tax dollars were going to pay for all of these extensions in deeply rural places that hardly anybody enrolled in, or vice versa. Like, well, we're paying all of our rural tax dollars so that city kids can have the big university. Then what we're stuck with is, you know, a trailer with a few agricultural science classes in it or something. Demarcation lines really were things like crossing a river or going over the hills. I'm originally from Portland. And as you were talking about, like, where does the city end and the suburbs start? And I'm kind of like, well, I'm sort of vaguely the West Hills. And now you're kind of in the suburbs. But but I don't know if people in Raleigh Hills would agree with me about that. Like, you know, they're those kind of like, those things are really interesting as you try to figure out a model for what makes a community of interest a community of interest? What do we have in common?
Right.
The reason I wanted to talk about that also is, I the focus on polls, I think, makes a lot of casual observers think that that's the sum total of data that political actors are working with. And so I did want to talk about things like these kinds of models of redistricting.
Yeah.
And how do those things fit in to the partisan side of campaigning?
What's interesting is that this redistricting model, which of course started purely for redistricting, we sort of realized after the maps were all set, it's like, oh, actually we can use this same model now for targeting, meaning like for, especially for legislative races, where, you know, if you're in a state with a whole lot of different legislative races and yes, a lot of them are going to be, you know, pretty far to the right or pretty far to the left. And so they're not very competitive. You all know that. But like, let's say you've got a collection of a dozen different districts that are going to be competitive. How are you, if you are a state party or the legislative caucus, or, you know, maybe you're a major union in the state or some kind of organization that really cares about that state's legislature, how are you supposed to allocate your resources and choose which districts you're putting money into? Because you have limited resources. You can't just put infinite money towards all of them. And so what we realized is that this model could be used for that purpose. I would feed the model into Monte Carlo simulations, which has kind of got popularized in the national media by Nate Silver, you know, those bell curves. And instead of saying like, well, we think that this candidate is going to get 53% of the vote, it's more like this candidate has a 76% chance of winning, like that kind of thing. And that's what we did, but with legislative predictions. And the model, even though the model was not built on polling at all, it was just built on various fundamentals, you know, like what were the legislative results last time? What is the general partisanship of the district? You know, is there an incumbent running? Is there a third party candidate running from the right? Is there a third party candidate running from the left? What kind of wave year is it? You know, those just sort of fundamentals. That model ended up being more accurate than polling. And, you know, I would put together these predictions a year in advance of the election, sometimes more. And those predictions would have pretty consistently, we've done this every cycle now since 2012, those predictions have been more accurate than legislative polling. And I want to say, you know, legislative polling usually has a smaller sample size, usually it's 400 people, 300 people. So there's a greater margin of error for legislative polling anyway. But you'd still think that like that the polls would be like reasonably good, or at least, you know, sort of responsive to whatever was happening out there, or, you know, the particulars of the actual candidates involved. Whereas my model was just like, is the Democrat going to win? Is the Republican going to win? What are the odds of that happening? And my model has been more accurate than polling, which is, I'm very proud of. I keep, every year I think that that's not going to happen. Like I have sort of imposter syndrome somehow, even after all these years, but like every year the model actually ends up being pretty accurate. And so that's the kind of resource that organizations can have, because they can say like, hey, you know, this incumbent over here that we really like, they keep asking us for more money. They're really scared they're going to lose their seat. But like the model says that they already have a 95% chance of winning. Like we don't want to just keep putting money over there because it's just not necessary. They're going to win. And maybe they'll only win by, you know, 7 points instead of the 10 points that they want to win by. But like a win's a win.
Right.
And we need to spend that money over here in this place that like, the model says we have a 30% chance of winning. Like we're actually more likely to lose it than win. But if we like really, really work hard and put a lot of resources into that district, maybe we can actually take this district and gain another seat in the legislature.
Right. One of the things I talked about with David last time was some of these changes to the way we vote that have been popularized, certainly like acceleration during the pandemic of more states offering early voting, absentee voting, more states adopting vote by mail, more states adopting same day voter reg, or like motor voter bills, or even like pre-registration for 17-year-olds. Like if you will be 18 by the date of the election, you can register in time for the election. And just quickly, because we had the New York 3rd special election, whatever day that was, Tuesday. Like there was early voting, there was a snowstorm, there were a lot of people kind of trying to figure out. I mean, apparently like turnout wasn't much different than it was in 2020. But nevertheless, like there appears to be some data, at least at the moment, Democrats are taking more advantage of early voting. Republicans are still showing up on voting day. And there have been these kind of narratives about partisanship on one method of voting versus another. And I know you have some experience with these kind of alternative approaches to voting.
Yeah, I've done actually a huge amount of research on vote by mail. I got commissioned many years ago to look at Colorado's implementation of vote by mail. They're just like, oh, is there anything you can tell us about, you know, the effect of vote by mail when they did it in Colorado? And I was like, all right, I'll take a look. And so it wasn't the strongest analysis because there was no sort of pseudo control group there, you know, like the whole state switched and then you have a new election. But we were at least able to show that in Colorado, you know, we have these things called vote propensity scores, which maybe David Radloff talked about a little bit. Yeah. Like that's all. Yeah. Like a turnout score, which is all based on your sort of past voting history. And so what we showed in Colorado was that when they implemented vote by mail, all these people with pretty low turnout scores, you know, like maybe they had a score of 10, meaning we thought that there's only a 10% chance that they would turn out. If you took all those people that had a turnout score of 10 in Colorado in 2014, when vote by mail got implemented, instead of only 10% of those people turning out, 30% of them turned out. Mm. And so especially for sort of low and mid propensity voters, we saw this really interesting pattern like that, that people were like really outperforming their expected turnout if they were sort of marginal voters. Mm-hmm. We couldn't say for sure that that was due to vote by mail because there were other things. There were things happening in that election. There was a Senate race that year, maybe that low propensity voters were particularly interested in. My favorite counterfactual is, you know, like it was the first year that pot was legal in Colorado. And maybe people, you know, instead of getting the munchies, they got the voties. Oh. And they just were like, yeah, now I'm smoking a joint and voting with my ballot here. I don't know. I don't actually think that happened. But, you know, there's a bunch of alternate explanations.
Yeah.
And so what we were able to do is we found a really good natural experiment in Utah, of all places, where Utah opted in to vote by mail kind of on a county by county basis. And so in 2014, 2016 in particular, there were some counties in Utah that were all vote by mail. They mailed everyone a ballot, and then some counties didn't. And so we were able to kind of use the counties that didn't opt in as a pseudo control group. You know, we controlled for other differences right. that were already there and showed that vote by mail really did have an effect. I mean, it increased turnout, again, mostly among low and mid propensity voters in Utah. People who are already high propensity voters, they're going to vote no matter what. Mm-hmm. But it turns out if you give everyone a ballot without them having to ask for it, it helps people. You know, it helps some people vote because it's like, oh, great, I didn't have to do anything. Like, there's this thing in my hand. Maybe I can spend a little time in front of my computer, like looking up how I should vote, what to think about this ballot initiative or that candidate. And so, yeah, it increased turnout. And we've seen that pretty consistently wherever we've looked at it. So I'm a big fan of vote by mail. I think that more states should be doing it. I live in Washington State. We're all vote by mail.
Right.
It is unfortunate that it's become partisan. And that really just is basically Trump telling the people that vote by mail is some big conspiracy. But I don't know. I'm hoping that that kind of goes away, that it becomes less politicized, just because I think it's really good for our country when more people participate, even if they're people that I don't necessarily agree with. Like, yeah. I think that more people voting is a good thing.
And I think we talked about this before as well. Like, that actually kind of started out as a Republican-led thing.
It did. Yeah. Yeah. Oregon was like the original vote by mail state. And yeah, it was rural Republicans that wanted to do it. And, you know, there was some Democratic resistance to it. But then, so Phil Kiesling, who was the Secretary of State and is also now a friend of mine, he's been one of the advisors to the National Vote at Home Institute, which has commissioned some of the research that I've done. He was a Democratic Secretary of State, but he said, yeah, this seems like good for turnout. This is like the right thing to do. And so it became more of a bipartisan thing at that point. And has Oregon's been voting by mail for a long time.
Right. And over time, I think one of the things that comes up frequently is this sense of some sort of partisan lean for people who vote early or vote by mail. And obviously that has been made partisan explicitly again recently.
Right.
But there were waves in Oregon of people feeling like, well, Democrats do better because it's vote by mail. But kind of over time, it looks like actually just sort of lifts voter turnout overall.
In the research that I like, especially in the places where we had the best opportunity to look at it, like Utah or Nebraska also, you know, it didn't skew strongly for one party or the other. I think in Utah, there was basically no partisan difference. In Nebraska, maybe there was like a small partisan difference, but that was also in 2020 when it had already been kind of politicized. Right. But it really wasn't. And actually, if anything, in Nebraska, like just because Nebraska is more Republican, like in terms of raw votes, vote by mail turned out more Republican than Democrats in Nebraska. I wish it weren't politicized. And I think if anything, I've also seen a little bit of research, or at least indications, that vote by mail just kind of amplifies what's already happening on the ground. So if it's like a real Republican wave year, I think that vote by mail actually probably helps Republicans because it just gets more people to vote who are sort of on the margins but are probably kind of going along with whatever the wave is. Mm-hmm. And in a Democratic year, then our side gets more of those votes and it's good for us. And I don't know, maybe because I'm an optimist and I think that our side has better messages, maybe there's a part of me that thinks like, vote by mail is better for Democrats because we're going to win the message war. We're going to get more people to turn out. We're going to be more persuasive. So of course it's going to be better for us. But like, we know that that doesn't actually always happen. You know, sometimes our optimism gets crushed and we spend years out in the wilderness. I don't know. I guess I'm trying to maintain my optimism a little bit.
That's great. So I don't want to necessarily punctuate your optimism in this way, but is there anything that you wish that like commentators, pundits, journalists, whatever would get a little more educated about, let's say, when it comes to the use of data and polling and covering political campaigns?
Yeah, I guess I would say that I don't think the polling affects campaigns all that much. It's sort of interesting and, you know, you pay attention to it from a messaging standpoint. You do want to know how you're doing. It's not that it matters, not at all, but I don't think it actually changes strategy all that much. Mm-hmm. I think that the process of going around and talking to people and reaching out to people is going to be the same regardless of what a poll says. So I think that there's just a lot more made of polls in the press than there is in a campaign headquarters.
I think it's a really good point, and something we did talk about this a bit with David as well, is like, even like looking at the history of public polling, a lot of the history of public polling is intertwined with trying to sell more newspapers and magazines. Like, it's really about that. It's about giving people something to chew on every day to make them feel like it's an exciting rip and everything could change at any moment when, you know, barring major events, campaigns are competitive and then we vote. That's the narrative of campaigns. They're competitive and then we vote. Sometimes they're not that competitive because one candidate is clearly stronger than another, or it's a wavier or whatever. But by and large, we're just going to get out and talk to people, and then they're going to do what they're going to do. And we find out what the results are after. But that narrative is not an exciting narrative. So they obsess about the thing that they can obsess about. They also don't have access to your analytics, and they can't see that stuff. So that's probably part of it too.
And it's not that the analytics inside the campaign necessarily tell you something different. It's just a different focus. Right. It's not like, oh, in a campaign, they know that secretly Biden's 10 points ahead. No, that's not like, it's not like that. It's just that it doesn't matter as much to how you're going to run the campaign.
Right.
You still got to go talk to people. You still got to test out messages in the moment, see what works in the moment, and try to marginally get more people to turn out for your side.
Yeah. Is there anything in particular you're seeing different in terms of what campaigns are doing with data or with data collection, data modeling, any of those things? Are there new things coming up?
You know, I don't know. I mean, it's been a while since I was on a campaign itself. Most of our clients are ongoing organizations now. I actually am a big believer that campaigns should bring their analytics teams in-house rather than hiring firms like mine to do analytics for them, because I think that, you know, having people in the headquarters really focused on that data as their entire job is actually the best way to do it. So I don't actually know like what the latest innovations are in campaign analytics. Yeah. But, you know, on our side, just, you know, working with organizations, it's just sometimes it's not very sexy. We're just, you know, building those models or building infrastructure to get data from point A to point B, trying to make things, you know, run more efficiently. I don't know. We just, you know, it's all a game of just making things marginally better, both from a voting perspective and also just from a time, like a campaign staffer or a organization staffer time perspective. Like, what can we do to just automate your processes a little bit better for you so that you can spend more of your time doing more important work?
I love that, because in a way that I gave you my least favorite question as a consultant and a researcher, which is like, oh, what cool new tools are you using to understand consumers? And I'm like, I'm still just talking to people. Trying to make it a little more efficient here and there, trying to automate parts of it where we can, but like mostly still just talking to people. There isn't a new way to do that. So
it's been fun. I guess that for me personally, I've been able to do more randomized controlled experiments outside of the digital space. So, you know, working on more experiments like with canvassing or text messages or phone calls or ads, persuasion ads, things like that. And that's been fun, especially because a lot of those experiments require a sort of trickier setup. So, for instance, with persuasion, we don't know who voted for which candidate. Secret ballots. Mm-hmm. God damn it. I just want to know who people voted for. That would be so nice. But, you know, if we only know at a precinct level who voted for the Democrat and who voted for the Republican, it means that we can run experiments where we randomized at the precinct level and try to apply some treatments towards some precincts and then have some precincts that are that serve as the control group and see if we can persuade people, affect their vote choice, but we can only see it at the precinct level. So that, you know, it's sort of interesting to run an experiment where you're not randomizing people, you're randomizing geographies. Yeah. Or, I don't know, we've run some Canvas experiments where instead of a control group, we have a placebo group, which, you know, for very nerdy reasons, ends up being a better way to run Canvas experiments. So but it means you have to, like, train Canvassers to do a placebo script where they talk about something kind of apolitical just to see who opens the door. Anyway, it's just like it's fun to work on lots of different types of experiments just because we get to do more different nerdy methodologies.
Well, I know that we've run out of time. I would love to talk more about those kinds of experiments because I think those are actually really interesting, like getting to the baseline of like who opens the door, like for any reason, like who answers the door.
Not a lot of people.
Yeah, I bet it's having done some canvassing myself, I know how many doors actually never open. I canvassed in 2016 in Coatesville, Pennsylvania, and it was a Sunday and football was on and the Eagles were playing. And so no one answered the door because it was during the game. And I was like, this was a terrible day to come. this is the day nobody wants to talk to you. So it was a lot of door knockers and not a lot of talking waters.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Anyway, well, Adelia, thank you so much for talking about the work that you do and the expertise you bring to it, because I think it's just a whole other part of the puzzle that most people never hear about. And I really appreciate
your
time.
Thank you so much for having me on the program.
Yeah,
appreciate you as well.
Okay, thank you.
Crosstabs is hosted by me, Farah Bostic. Production by The Difference Engine and edited by me. Music from Audio Jungle by S Audio. Find us at crosstabspodcast.com, where you can subscribe to our weekly newsletter, tell your friends about the show, and subscribe on your favorite podcast service. See you next time.